country to join the European Union. He's a founder of the Subversive Festival, an annual event in Zagreb. His other most recent book, which I'm afraid is so far only available in German and Croatian, isn't it? Is After the End of History, from the Arab Spring to the Occupy Movement. And you may also know him from his Guardian columns, a very recent one which was on immigration. And also we have here Kostas Tsitsinas. He's a professor of law at Birkbeck College. He's also director of the Birkbeck Institute for the Humanities and a visiting professor at the University of Athens, I believe.
And various others, yes.
And various others, yes.
Athens will have money in the more, so...
Okay. he works on very many topics, human rights, aesthetics, postmodern legal theory, and political philosophy. The author of numerous books, the most recent of which is called Philosophy and Resistance in the Crisis.
That came out.
Yes. The book we're talking about this evening, it's got a foreword and then 19 chapters, most of which alternate between chapters by Slavoj and chapters by Šeško. It covers a huge range of themes, including debt, democracy, political corruption, nationalism, religion, the oppressor and the victim, immigration, and even jokes. So I'd like to start by inviting Šeško to give his comments on the book and on some of the issues that it raises. Over to you.
So, since you mentioned jokes, I will start with a joke, but before the joke, I would like to use the opportunity to thank my publisher for the book and to thank Kostas for his friendship, but also for being here. Actually, we've seen each other just 4 days or 5 days ago at the Belgrade Book Fair, where Kostas was presenting his book. And I think these two books are actually complementary. They speak about very similar, I mean, they speak about the same topic, about the crisis of Europe. So, as Richard mentioned, Croatia is the latest member of the European Union. And I'll start by a joke. Since Slavo is not here, I will use one of the most famous Slavoj jokes, but I will use it differently. I will give the first part of the joke and do a parallel with Croatia. You know all the joke about the patient and the doctor, of course. You know, the patient comes to the doctor and asks him, oh, doctor, can you please tell me I'm ill? Can you tell me what is happening? It's hurting everywhere, my head, my stomach, and so on. And the doctor says, I have a bad news and I have a good news for you. Do you want to hear first the bad or the good? And of course, the patient says, I want to hear the bad news. And the doctor says, the bad news is you have cancer. But the good news is the time when you come home, you won't remember anything because you have Alzheimer's. And I would say the same goes for the entrance of Croatia to the European Union. You know, the bad news is Croatia is in a huge financial crisis, corruption affairs everywhere. Our ex-prime minister is now currently in jail. Our ex-finance minister is now in jail as well. Privatizations, high unemployment, and so on and so on. And what is the good news? Croatia just joined the European Union. We have more jokes like this in the book, and I also give a new twist to the joke, because I think we could switch the positions as well, which makes it sound a bit strange, but it's proven right. So the bad news is actually that the European Union, of course, is in a great crisis with corruption affairs, with Jacques Chirac, the German president, and so on, high unemployment. And what is the good news? The good news is Croatia just entered the club. Why is this the good news? My thesis is, and I mentioned it in one chapter of the book, that like the Nobel Peace Prize was the best legitimation that the European Union is still a peace-providing project, which of course isn't, especially if we look at the interventions in Mali, in Syria, in Afghanistan, and so on. Like this, the entrance of Croatia had the purpose to serve as a legitimation that the enlargement of Europe still makes sense. Of course, today, just, I don't know, 100 days after the entrance of Croatia, no one believes in this anymore, and no one believed in this even before the entrance, but this was the main agenda. I don't know if you knew that the European Union actually invested 20 million euros for a positive campaign all around Europe so that the European countries won't so they don't have any fear from the Croatians coming to the European Union. And at the same time, the Croatian government spent 600,000 euros for a positive campaign for the EU referendum. The result of this EU referendum was the lowest turnout in the European history. It was 43%. The previous record holder was, of course, Hungary, with 45%. So the situation today is that no one has optimism about the European Union anymore, and I think Kostas knows this much better than me because he comes from Greece. But what I would like to mention, to go a step further from the book and not to repeat some texts from the book, because it's already boring if you have, you know, the text and then repeat them, is a recent statement by the European Commission. Several weeks ago they mentioned that the Balkans is still a place full of homophobia and a place where the free market still doesn't function. Why is this interesting? Because of several points. One point is, of course, the point of the myth of the Balkans, which still preserves all around Europe, but also in the Balkans. And you have very interesting developments that the people from the Balkans interiorize the myth of the Balkans, and they now behave like the Balkan myth of the European Union. And it's funny because 2004 or 2005, when the negotiations with Croatia opened, a daily newspaper in Croatia published its front page with the title saying "Bye-bye Balkans." So now we are not the Balkans anymore. And you know, the Balkans is the place where we kill, where we rape, and all the other things which you know from Emir Kusturica movies. But what is wrong with the statement of the European Commission? I think it's a very problematic statement. The statement said Balkan is still a homophobic place where the free market doesn't function. My thesis, and I don't mention it in the book, but I'm developing it in new texts, and many scholars, not many scholars, but some scholars from the Balkans as well now, mainly from the field of political economy, I think that the European Commission didn't admit that actually the free market is the creator of homophobia and of nationalism. I'm not sure if everyone here will agree with this thesis, but if you look at the history of Yugoslavia, then we come to some very, very, very interesting facts. And actually my thesis, and of some people, not many, is that the nationalism, the collapse of Yugoslavia wasn't a result of nationalism, but it was the other way around. Nationalism was a result of the collapse of Yugoslavia. You know, the prevailing thesis is that people from the Balkans in 89 and 90, in Serbia, in Slovenia, in Bosnia, not Slovenia, but in Bosnia and in Croatia and so on, just one night they decided to hate the Serbs, the Croats and so on, and then the war started because there were always nationalist tensions there. My thesis is that actually the free market, and that's the thing the European Commission is not mentioning, created all these tensions. If you look to the transcripts of the party, of the congresses of the Communist Party in Yugoslavia, you will find very interesting information. So, for example, already in 51, this is several years after the partisans succeeded to defeat the fascists in Yugoslavia, Boris Kidrich, a high member of the Communist Party, at the party congress said, the biggest danger for Yugoslavian socialism is the sort of monopolistic capitalism that is already now existing in the Soviet Union. In 71, another very high-ranked official party member called Vladimir Bakarić, and I'm sure some people here know about him, said something even more interesting. He said, the biggest problem with the Yugoslavian experiment of self-management is that the surplus value is not going back anymore to the factories, but is going to the financial markets and to the financial markets who became autonomous now. So what you have in Yugoslavia from the 50s to the 80s and to the 90s, I would say, is the same or very similar to the situation which you have today in the European Union. So on the one hand, you had Albania, you had Kosovo, which was the periphery of Yugoslavia. On the other hand, you had, of course, Belgrade, Ljubljana, Zagreb, Serbia, Croatia, Slovenia, which was the center of the of Yugoslavia. Like today in Europe, you have France and Germany. On the other hand, you have the PIGS and so on, Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, and now joined by Croatia as well. What you have then during the already during the 70s, I don't know if you're familiar with the numbers. The numbers of the GDP of the GDP of Yugoslavia was the today's numbers of China almost. It was around 7 and 8%.
You mean the growth, not the GDP.
The growth.
A bit strange.
Sorry, the growth.
Same
of the
GDP.
Yeah. I'm sorry. All the time. Last week I was at the Belgrade Book Fair speaking Serbo-Croat. The week before speaking German. I'm a bit. And of course I'm speaking this bad accent. I try to. Anyway, what happened during the 70s is you had harsh austerity measures, and in the 80s you already have the International Monetary Fund intervening in Yugoslavia. You had, I think, two or three loans, and in 89 the former minister, I think, of finance went to George Bush to take the last loan. And of course, when you have, I think the number is in 86, you had more than 1 million people who were on the streets without a job. And if you have such a huge dissatisfaction, if you have such a huge number of unemployment, and of course I'm now simplifying things because we don't have enough time to go into detail, then nationalism is around the corner. And I would say something similar is happening today in Europe as well, as we can see in Greece, in all parts of Europe, also in UK. And I think actually the European Union could learn a lot from the Yugoslavian experience, what happened in Yugoslavia, not only with the relation between the center and the periphery, but also what happened with the austerity measures and with what happened with the Yugoslavian experiment. I don't know if I wanted to add something else, maybe more on the book. But there is an anecdote Kostas doesn't know. And it's about self-management, because quite often people from abroad come to Croatia and say, oh, you had the experiment of self-management, this was really great. So just to make it clear, I'm not someone here who will like speak only positive things about the Yugoslavian experiment, because there were also bad things. And actually what we have to do is also to investigate the self-management experience. But there is a very nice anecdote told by one of the last members of the, I don't know if you know, the Praxis group. This was a very famous, let's say, dissident, semi-dissident group from the 60s who founded the Portugal School of Philosophy, where Ernst Bloch, Marcuse, and all the guys were coming. He describes an event during the 60s when Gaja Petrović, one of the most famous members of the Praxis School, invited Erich Fromm to Yugoslavia. So Erich Fromm, the famous sociologist, the author of Sane Society and so on, comes to Yugoslavia. He visits a factory, and at a factory he meets a worker, a trade unionist, and the director of the factory. And all the time Erich Fromm poses questions, and this Gaja Petrović, this famous philosopher, tries to translate. But as the time is running, Gaja Petrović is not really translating all the parts, and now you will hear why. So all the time, Erich Fromm is speaking to is asking the worker, but all the time the director is answering the questions and not the worker. So he asks first, please, dear worker, can you tell us, do you have a library like this? Do you read books? Do you still investigate, you know, the current problems of socialism? And then the director answers and says, this belongs to an overcome phases of socialism. We don't do this anymore. Then Erich Fromm asks the director, can you please tell us where is the surplus, where you're going? And of course the director says, it's not going to the factories anymore, it belongs to an overcome phases of socialism and so on. And in the end, of course, Gaja Petrović, the Yugoslavian philosopher, didn't translate all the things, and Erich Fromm went home believing the experiment of self-management is still, It's still extremely successful, but it's not. I mean, that was an anecdote about Yugoslavia, because obviously not all things were working well. And actually, I would use this occasion to invite you tomorrow to UCLA to see
UCL.
UCL.
It's not a,
yeah.
UCL, because yeah. It would be lovely to go to UCLA.
Yes, but it's far away. Because we have a seminar with some scholars from the Balkans, like Renata Saleci, Ligor Štiks, but also Kostas Slapavicas, whom you probably know, where will we go more into detail into all these details. I will end here, and maybe I will later try to say more about the book, but this was just the beginning, and I will leave the floor to Kostas.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks very much.
Okay, let me start, because I have a bad back. Let me start by saying that you should all buy this book and read it. I've read most of it, and it's quite wonderful. It has those excellent twists where you read about something that you know, and suddenly with a little twist, with a joke, with a little pun and so on, you know, so that takes you in a totally different direction. Of course, I have to say that, first of all, because, as you realize, Srećko and I and his friends in Zagreb and Belgrade have a mutual fan club, and they were promoting my book in Belgrade last week. But I think Srećko and his friends have created a wonderful institution called the Subversive Forum, Subversive Festival, which is now continuing in different forms in Belgrade and elsewhere, and has created again a sense of excitement, I think, throughout the Balkans, particularly throughout former Yugoslavia. And of course, Slavoj Žižek is a great friend. Let me remind you, if you don't know, that later in November, at the end of November, he's given a masterclass at Birkbeck, just up the road. Places have run out, there are very few places. If you want to come to the masterclass for a whole week to listen to Slavoj Žižek and his jokes, you know, you have to register in the next couple of days. And of course, Alexis Tsipras, the leader of the Radical Left Party, who writes the introduction and conclusion of this book, I think has become now a pretty important European figure. I remember when he spoke here in London in March of last year, and there was such a sense of revival in the audience. At the end, an English friend stood up and said, "Why didn't you come to run here in London, you know, at least for the local elections? We need someone like you." And of course, he's running actually now, even in London, because only last week Tsipras was adopted as the candidate for the presidency of the European Commission in the forthcoming European elections, European Parliament elections, and therefore, you know, he may come to London to canvass votes and do hustings, you know, for that election, because that would be a pan-European election. So I want to say a few things about Europe, following on from Srećko and commenting on the book. In 2001, at the end of the introduction of the euro, major European intellectuals like Jürgen Habermas or Ulrich Beck stated that the 21st century will be known as the European century. The 20th was the American century with all the atrocities and so on. 21st century, the European century. That the European Union, with the introduction of the euro, the expansion eastward, the end of wars, as if Yugoslavia is not part of Europe. But anyway, the end of wars has created a model for the whole of humanity. So that will be the model that will be expanded and exported to the rest of the world, constitutional patriotism, all the rest of it, and therefore we have to be hopeful, Habermas and Beck were saying. Ulrich Beck recently published a book called German Europe, which opens with the following line. "In February 2010, I heard on the news that today the Bundestag, the federal parliament of Germany, will decide the future of Greece." And Beck says, "I was absolutely astounded, aghast at that kind of statement." Cut here a joke, since we do jokes. This man arrives at the airport of Athens. He goes to immigration control. Immigration officer says, "Nationality?" He says, "German." "Occupation?" No, "I'm here for holidays." Now, that kind of attitude, both on the German and on the Greek side, I think represents what has happened in the decades since 2001. The major foundational principles of the European Union that go, of course, back to the idea of Europe as we understand it from, I suppose, the Mediterranean, the middle of the earth, you know, the Medium Terum, and so on, all the way to the Enlightenment. So all the major foundational principles have been violated, and actually flagrantly violated. And I refer here now to democracy, to the idea of well-being and prosperity, and of course the idea of social justice and solidarity. And this is what I want to refer to in the next few minutes, those three principles and how they have been violated and how perhaps we may see some better future ahead of us. All great ideas in Europe, things like the nation, socialism, natural rights and human rights, started as ideas that were developed by intellectuals of different kinds, liberals, socialists, and so nationalists, and then were adopted by the mass of citizens in different countries and became leading forces, ideologically leading forces in those countries. The idea of a united Europe has not become that. As the German Constitutional Court has repeatedly said, in Europe we do not have a demos, which is the main characteristic or component of a democracy. In other words, we have not developed a conception of belonging, of being together, of having the same kind of references and cultures and language in London and in Athens and in Zagreb. So while we have a small elite that keeps moving around and going to Brussels and to Strasbourg and Luxembourg, and they get in the grants and they are members of this committee structure, the comitology as it is known, the majority of the population basically has not bought into that idea as yet. And I think this is quite understandable. Let me say a few things about democracy, the first of the three grand ideas or ideals that perhaps the European integration had promised. At the federal level, of course, you may have heard the idea of a democratic deficit, that the European Union suffers from a democratic deficit. Of course, the truth of the matter is that it suffers from a total lack of democracy. All the major principles of a standard constitutional, liberal constitutional arrangement, the separation of powers, a parliamentary accountability, some kind of executive transparency, do not exist or are pretty rudimentary in Europe. The separation of powers, the commission appointed by governments, is then the main legislative initiator, but also, that is like parliament, but also it is the main law enforcer and therefore acts like the executive. Parliament has extremely limited powers. They have been slightly increased, but the bottom line is that parliament neither legislates nor holds the executive, the commission, to account. Finally, in terms of transparency, I'll tell you something which is quite striking. This famous or infamous Troika that currently is running Greece and Portugal and Cyprus and Ireland. And it's running those countries like a kind sort of colonial power, a colonial viceroy who goes in there and decides both from questions of general policy, so reduction of pensions and salaries and so on, all the way down to very specific details, how many civil servants will be sacked this year and so on. Now, this body, the Troika, has absolutely no accountability to anyone. There is no body in European Parliament, or indeed in the Commission, or in any other institutional arrangement in which those three characters and their sidekicks can go and give some kind of account about what they're doing. Of course, now the European Parliament, as of next week, they may set up a committee. But of course, now the harm has been done. And as a result of that kind of absence of democracy at the European level, European policymakers, but also European academics, the Europeanists, have developed a very strong approach according to which democratic participation is unnecessary at the level of the European Union. One particular character, professor at Oxford, writes in a recent book that the idea of democratic participation in questions of European policy runs, I quote, counter to a consensual social scientific understanding of how advanced democracies work. So it is against our understanding. Democracies do not expect to have anything like that. And he goes on, and that is a position made by a number of people, to argue that the great advantage of the European Union and the huge amount of laws that it introduces, up to 70 or even 80% now of the legislation that all of us have in our national capitals, comes from Brussels. So one of the great advantages is that that kind of legislation and the overall operation of the European Union is so boring, and they use the term, so uninteresting, so makes people switch off from the European Union, and that is a great thing. Because otherwise, if people became more interested in the comings and goings and the legislation and policy of the European Union, then you would have trouble. And this is the reason that when it was decided to introduce a president and the foreign secretary of the European Union, they appointed people that nobody knows or recognizes. Do you know who is the foreign secretary of the European Union?
Labour
peers. But you don't remember the name? You don't remember the name. Okay, but Tony Blair. Tony Blair fancied himself as perhaps, you know, a candidate for the presidency. And the way he put it, or some of his friends, and they put it in the media, you need someone that when he arrives in the capital, the people go out in the streets because they would want to see him. And they thought that Blair, you know, so was something like that. Now, of course, they went precisely for the opposite, for people who nobody knows, nobody cares about. And Mr. Van Rompuy is the president, and Lady Ashton, that nobody knows, is the foreign secretary. So that is the idea of a kind of disinterest for democracy, which, of course, has been returned in kind by the people. Sreczko mentioned the accession referendum. But, of course, in the two major referenda about the so-called European Constitution, INECO countries, France and the Netherlands, voted against. INECO, it is not, you know, Greece or Britain, God forbid. It was INECO that voted against. And the word referendum, of course, is a dirty word in the corridors of power in Brussels. But if we move even internally now into domestic politics, that kind of the European idea is being mimicked and reinforced by a total undermining of any even classical liberal conceptions of democratic accountability and popular participation. In April, I had a live debate on Canadian national TV with the director of an American think tank called the American Enterprise Society or something, which is the kind sort of the heart of neoliberal politics. And we were talking about what is happening in Southern Europe, and at some point I was describing the humanitarian crisis in Greece. You know that hospitals don't work, so schools don't work, homelessness, suicide, mental health problems, and so on. And I said that, you know, of course, this is the obvious result of a 25% reduction of the GDP over a period of 4 years. And what did the guy respond? He said, yes, of course, I understand that. That's a bit of a problem. In reality, Greece has to lose 35% of its GDP. The only problem is that politicians are not prepared to push so hard. So I said, why? Because they're going to lose elections, he says. So I said, then perhaps it would be better if we didn't have elections. And he says, of course, I cannot say that in public, although he had just said it, but it is perhaps a better idea to have the experts and the economists and the social policy gurus decide, you know, how they are going to deal with huge populations without asking us, the hoi polloi, the plebs, you know, the people and so on, to have any view of that. We have reached a stage now within an internal arrangement, something that exists here in Britain also, where democracy and capitalism seem to be incompatible. That the democratic principle and the idea of the sovereign of the markets, the sovereign of the people, as it were, and the sovereign of the markets appear to be conflicting, contradictory. You cannot have both together. So, what does Europe want? Now, of course, I see the audience here, most of you know your Freud, and you know that this is a famous expression that Freud uses: what does the woman want? And I'm sure that, you know, sort of you adopted it from that. And of course, the question, the Freudian question about what does the woman want, is a reference to a certain perplexion that men feel about female sexuality. we just don't hack it. What is this? What is it? What can I do? What do you want? Now, of course, they say, what does Europe want? I mean, the obvious question in reality is, what does Mrs. Merkel want? What does Mrs. Merkel want? This is the real question that we're all faced with and have been faced with for the last few years. And to my mind, there are kind of two answers. One is that Mrs. Merkel, in good Freudian terms, plays the role of the superego. You may remember the film The White Ribbon, where a pastor keeps punishing his children. And the more they obey, the more he punishes them. That is the role of the superego, sadistic. You know, tells you, do this or don't do that. And when you obey, then you get even greater punishment. That's the one thing. The second now, and that takes us to the elites of Croatia or of Greece. The elites, the Europeanized or modernizing elites of the periphery, including Croatia, have Mrs. Merkel and that Western kind of arrangement as their great ego ideal. In other words, they try to act in the way that they imagine Mrs. Merkel wants them to act. That is the idea, the ego ideal in Freudian theory. So, in the case of Greece, which is the most obvious one, they try to think, what does Mrs. Merkel want? Now, Mrs. Merkel, at one point, says, we want to keep Greece and the rest in the euro. At other points, she says, no, we would prefer perhaps to kick Greece and the rest from the euro. And at other points, she does not say what she wants. So therefore now, the jilted lovers or prospective lovers are left in a certain doubt. What does she want? And they try all the time to divine her desire in order to act according to that desire that they don't know. And of course, again, in pure Freudian theory, that precisely leads in the sexual domain in the perpetuation of desire, because I never know what you want, and therefore I'm always trying, you know, sort of to adjust myself to my imaginary interpretations of your desire. In the case of the elites, they always try to do what they think the Europeans want. And to that extent, they have become, particularly the pigs, and it's a very interesting, humiliating term that has been adopted for those southern European countries which Croatia has just joined. They have become collection agencies. They collect money from their populations and they give it back to the German and the French banks. It is quite amazing, and here I'm finishing now with the business about prosperity and well-being, that the ratio between the Greek GDP and Greek debt was 120%, 120% of debt in relation to the Greek gross domestic product in 2009, at the beginning of the crisis. Only last week, the European Statistic Authority said that currently the debt is 170% of Greek GDP. In other words, after 5 years of extreme suffering, of destruction of lives, of death that has dismantled the Greek society, the debt is 50% higher as a proportion of GDP than it was 5 years ago. And you have something quite unique. The IMF, which is one of the troika, of the three colonial overseers, admitted that they made a huge mistake. That when they were calculating the effects of the recession, they totally messed up what is known as the fiscal multiplier. So the fiscal multiplier tells you what happens to the real economy when you take money out of it, when you go into a devaluation. And they had calculated that every euro that goes out of the economy through the cut of pensions and salaries and the sacking of civil servants and so on would lead to 0.5 of recession, of reduction of the GDP. 0.5. 1 euro you take out and only 0.5, 50p, as it were, get out of the economy. They had messed up by a factor of 3. Every euro was leading to 1.5 contraction of the economy. And this was the reason why, of course, they were expecting Greece to have totally solved the problem of the deficit. and entered again the markets 3 years ago. And of course, Greece, even this year, is 9% in deficit. So, you have clearly here the best definition of ideology. Ideology that tells people, those characters, IMF, EU, and so on, that there is a truth in terms of how you run a country, how you make a country more economical and so on. And even when it is absolutely clear, because they admitted it first, that's how we know, they wrote papers and said, sorry, we messed up. Even after they admitted it, they said, however, we continue with exactly the same policies. This is the definition, a classical definition of ideology. I know that what I'm doing is wrong, is false, is catastrophic. However, I go on doing it. This is, my friends, what is happening at this point all over Europe. And I want to finish also with the good news, because there is some good news. And the good news is that if these places are known as pigs, you know, occasionally pigs can fly. And pigs have started flying all over Europe, but with particular flashpoints. And I think Greece and Spain are at the forefront. People have started resisting. We had a huge round of different types of resistances all over Europe, as you know, in 2011 and continues 2012, with some peaks and some falls and so on. But for the first time, it seems to me, since the 60s, the events of 68 and so on, some of us all did remember, we have again entered in Europe and all over the world what I would call an age of resistance. People have said in various ways and different degrees of intensity and organization, enough is enough. We're not going to take it anymore if you are acting in such an irrational, catastrophic, immoral way. And this is, to me, in a sense, the good news. That the idea now of solidarity and of social justice that comes from the tradition of the Enlightenment, exactly as democracy and equality and freedom and so on, is now being resurrected again. And I think a book like this, precisely by putting those questions and those obvious answers on the agenda, is helping to promote and to think again a different kind of Europe that has no such ideological orthodoxy and dogma, but it moves again back and links with that great idea of Europe, of freedom, equality, and fraternity, which is very much our tradition and which we need to bring back on the road again. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Kostas. We've got lots of themes to think about in what both of our speakers said. We now understand the psychoanalysis of our relationships with Angela Merkel, which is very useful. let's open it up to you. Who's got a question or a comment?
I can't understand. Do you want to stay? Do you want Britain to invent a referendum to stay in the EU or not? I thought that's what we're discussing. Is it, in other words, is it to Britain's advantage to stay in the EU? Because I think according to you a lot, it's not. According to two speakers, I take it you don't like the EU. Listening to you,
I think it's a question for Kostas.
And it's a question for the people of Britain when we come to vote. I suppose the year after next, or 2 years' time, 2-3 years down the line. So I do not want to get into that discussion at the minute. The question was about the euro. Britain rightly did not enter the euro.
Should Britain stay in the EU? That's my question.
Yeah. As I said, you know, sort of I will hedge my bets at the minute. I'm more interested in the referendum over Scottish independence. Once that happens, then I will tell you how I will vote the second one.
But I could answer from the Croatian perspective if you want. And it's not about Britain, but maybe you have some parallels. You know, when before Croatia was entering the European Union, there was a strong movement, which is now interesting, from the right and from the left. And they had pretty similar ideas. I mean, the audience, the public believed there were similar ideas, although there weren't. and they were both opposed to the entrance of Croatia to the European Union. And you even had one radical leftist called Samir Amin, who was born in Egypt, now is teaching in Senegal, one of the founding fathers of the World Social Forum, who said what you have to do, and he was several times in Croatia as well, what you have to do in the Balkans is to delink. This is his old thesis from the 70s of the delinking, which means actually you have to delink from the capitalist global system. And so, you know, me and Slavoj was the one, we posed him the question, okay, if we delink from the European Union, what will we have? You know, because the reason, man, it's not the same in UK, but you can imagine some similar scenario. Who was coming to Serbia to try to invest in Serbia? On the one hand, it was Russia, who already with Gazprom has many investments in Serbia. On the other hand, it's the United Arab Emirates, who are now buying the land and who now bought the national airlines in Serbia. So this means the linking. You will have a Russian or Arab Serbia. And you know that the point why I'm opposed to the linking as a leftist is that Croatia is already part of the European Union. I mean, the constitution was changed already before the referendum. Everything is changed. We're part of the free market. And me and Kostas wouldn't call it actually neoliberalism. I would call it ordoliberalism, the old German word for what is actually happening. And that's a strong state intervention who is helping the free market to function. It's not a free market at all. You know, the biggest monopolist in Croatia, they're avoiding, they're not paying taxes. I mean, the same as in Britain. I still remember the protest 2011, I think it was, against the biggest tax avoiders in Britain. So, and that's another story by Alexis Tsipras, who wrote the foreword for the book. He said to Slavoj, not to me, but maybe also to Kostas, and I think Slavoj made it publicly, so we can speak about it publicly. Before the last Greek elections, you know who was coming to Tsipras? The Russians and the Chinese. And they said, okay, if you win, can we build, that was the Russians, can we build an army base there and you go out of the euro and so on. And the Chinese, of course, had also some other plans and some other investments. And already the Chinese, as we all know, have more than 50% of Piraeus, the biggest ports in Europe. So my question is...
And the first thing they did, the Chinese, after the Chinese company bought the management of the Piraeus port, was to abolish trade unions for a communist country, was rather nice.
And to lower salaries.
Of course.
So my question is, okay, if UK comes out of the EU, what is the result of this delinking? I mean, you're already part of the European market, you already follow some rules and so on. Of course, the Russians are not coming to UK, so you have an easier situation.
No, they're coming individually.
Yeah.
Buy houses. Yeah.
Lots of houses in Mayfair.
Yeah.
Or football clubs.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Or newspapers. Indeed. Well, you know, so we can escalate. Yeah, that.
You can become a new Montenegro.
Leaving the UK, leaving the EU aside for a moment, do you think that... Okay, do you think that maybe Greece, Croatia, all of these other countries, you know, separate and apart from the UK, within the EU, with weaker economies, do you think if they all left the EU one by one, it would weaken the European Union as a whole? Do you think it would dismantle the European Union?
I mean, very quickly to say that if, for example, Greece, which is the weak link, either left the euro or was pushed out of the euro, according to all the available information we have, the financial first and the economic crisis would be so huge internationally, I mean globally, all over the world, not just in Europe, that the future of the euro, you know, sort of would be really in danger. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, they're not going to push Greece out of the euro, and also for different reasons that the majority of the Greek the Greek left is not in favor of leaving the euro. Now, in relation to the European Union, there, you know, so I'll go back to something that Sreczko say, and, you know, sort of I totally agree with him. The idea of a union of European states which sticks to those liberal and democratic traditions, I'm not talking about any socialism or anything like that, but, I mean, here in Britain, for example, you know, our main anti-discrimination legislation, both in terms of sex and race, came to this country in the 60s as a result of European Union directives and regulations. Because at that point, of course, the mainstream in Brussels, the Franco-German axis at that time, was social democratic. It was very much part of the post-war arrangement, the post-war alliance between industry, the unions, and government. And therefore, you know, sort of they did have, in social democratic terms, you know, some quite progressive policies. Of course, these policies were also the result, particularly in this country, of the strength of the trade unions and the struggle of the trade unions. But there was that aspect. And, you know, to the extent that, as Sreczko, I think, intimated, the models, the alternative models we have in the world today, one is that kind of authoritarian capitalism that goes with the name of communism in China, or some totally neoliberal casino and gangster capitalism that partly we see in Russia. If these are the two models, thank you, but no thanks. I don't want either of those. And to that extent, a kind of union that would go back eventually to some of its principles, obviously it cannot go back to its social democratic genesis because of all sorts of all kinds of reasons. It is something that, you know, it seems to me that on the whole is positive. Now, we may not become a federation, certainly we will not become a single state, we will not follow the Habermas, you know, wet dreams and so on of cosmopolitanism and all the rest of it, but having a basis, having a home in which, while keeping our different cultures and languages and traditions, but on the other hand, pulling together in terms of the international scene and so on, and going back to what I keep insisting, which is, you know, our founding principles of the Enlightenment, yeah, I would want to keep that.
There are so many questions that I think...
Okay.
Yes, I mean, that's... The trick is, how do we do it? How do we finesse the problem?
Absolutely.
I think your introductions were excellent. You've put your finger on the problem. The question is, how do we get there? And the only way I can see it, I mean, I come from a left-wing perspective,
sure,
is basically to vote to leave. Because I don't see how, and then put it back together again.
Yeah.
I'm European, but I'm not pro-EU.
No.
I mean, it's a hardwired neoliberal construct.
Yeah.
And there is no... There is no democracy in it. I don't see how we can change it other than having a new international conference with all the states or a majority or something, or the Greeks and the British and the pigs getting together.
The
and sort of saying we have to remake this thing.
And getting slaughtered, yes, the pigs. Good bacon, yeah.
Is it fancy rewriting the European Constitution? Again?
I'm completely in favor. No, what I would like to add also to the previous question and what Costa said and what you just asked is actually that I don't think the solution is if all the pigs just leave the European Union. I think the solution is if the pigs unite, and that's already happening. You know, if Alexis Tsipras and Syriza wins in Greece, this could be a huge victory also for the rest of Europe. Although the problem is that in the rest of Europe you don't have a similar party like Syriza. You had the Front de Gauche in France, which didn't succeed, and now what we read is that Le Pen will probably have a huge success on the next European elections. But what I think is the solution is if the countries of the periphery with similar problems unite, or even when it comes to Balkan countries, which were once part of, as I said, a country called Yugoslavia, reunite, and that's the only way to re-establish Europe, I think. Exactly on the ideas of the Enlightenment, on the French Revolution, of the trade union movement, and so on.
And just to add that, you know, in a sense, even if few countries were to leave, the way in which globalized economies work means that, you know, the decisions are being taken anyway in financial markets, with a huge movement of capital, you know, which is all digital and, you know, immaterial and so on, and which of course leads, you know, sort of to people losing their lives and losing their homes, losing their jobs and so on. So it's not that, you know, sort of it's not that easy. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So,
anyway.
You sort of talk as if democracy sort of has existed. We need to go back to it. We got the vote, I think, in England, men and women in 1930. I think Spain had had the vote for about 40 years and Greece for about the same.
No, the Greece had it for a longer period, but France got it in 48
yeah,
women.
Yeah, it doesn't work. I mean, mean, basically, all our societies are just capitalism. They're just run by plutocracies and oligarchies and people who don't like us, who really don't like us, who think we're here to be milked, either for our work or because they want us to borrow money at ridiculous interest rates. We have a bigger problem than you're suggesting, that we somehow go back. I mean, I voted against the common market, as it was called then, because, I mean, anybody on the left knew that it was just a club of businessmen, it's a club of capitalists. They've made themselves stronger. What's happened in the last 40 years is we've all got much, much weaker. And so, yes, it's got to go.
Yes.
It's got to go. But so do they, you know. And there's one thing, when they criticise the gulags, I think, yeah, but Cameron, Blair, Clegg, no, maybe there's something in that.
Well, any thoughts
on that? Anna, any thoughts on that?
You know, I don't disagree with your general view. You know, on the other hand, it seems to me when you speak to an audience like this, and where people, you know, sort of agree with you, you know, we are the converted, we are the usual suspects, we are the captive audience. It's one thing, but when you have to go out and try to persuade other people, you know, sort of you have to create kinds of demands that appear on the surface pragmatic and realistic, but which have within them the possibility, you know, to push, once they have achieved, to push further. I mean, today, perhaps, as you know, my union, the University of College University and Colleges Union, has a strike. And we didn't teach. Today, most of the university campuses were picketed and so on. Now, the strike was mainly about our pay, which has declined. I mean, there's no doubt all that is true. But at this point, you know, sort of our universities are going through one of the hugest changes and transformations in their very nature, in their soul, in their very mission and so on. And of course, if we had put also those kinds of questions about governance of universities, about evaluation, about the way in which we've turned into businesses and our students are now customers, and we have, you know, to act as if, you know, we're selling toothpaste or we're producing toothpaste. Now, if you had that kind of demand there and you had to argue around it and campaign around it, then you could push towards further things. So this is what I'm saying. I mean, I'm not a liberal. I mean, as I said, this book here has been accused in the press for being for violence, insurrection, I don't know, anything, the gulags, anything you want to name. However, it seems to me that also trying to create policy, particularly in the case of Greece, and we have some Greek friends here, where you are on the eve of a government, the first radical left government in Europe, elected radical left government. Now, my friends and colleagues and comrades in Athens, you know, I'm also involved in some kind of peripheral role, we don't have any precedent, any you know, blueprint, any rule book, you know, to take off the shelf and say, let's do it. So you have to experiment, you have to keep thinking, to imagine things. And the one thing you don't want to do is precisely to alienate those people who suffer as much, who may be on the right or even nationalists, they suffer as much as people on the left and internationalists and lefts and so on. You do not want to alienate. You want to bring them with you in order precisely to start a gradual transformation that could also have effects for the rest of Europe.
Okay, thanks very much. I've seen 5 hands up and I'm a bit nervous about time. 2 at the front, 2 near the back and 1 in the middle ground. So I'm going to take a couple of comments together and then invite response to them and then take a couple more and hope we can get to everybody that way.
You do seem to create a big victim mentality in the sense that...
A victim?
Victim, yeah. In that, like, what has gone wrong? You sort of say, oh, this horrible world, and Angela Merkel has been doing all these horrible things to us, you know. But there is no responsibility of... Maybe we have done something something wrong somewhere. You don't mention anything about that, you know. I would like you to investigate that side of the thing a little bit more than just purely sit there and saying what this thing.
Sure.
Also, when you buy into democracy, there is more to it than just say, oh, we're all free now. There's a thing like we are going to do the same amount. We're often to contribute to the same amount.
Sure.
If we are in a democracy... There is not just like we all have the boat now. There is a much bigger part of the contract that comes along
you don't address that at all. You just talk about the unfairness of democracy. We are in, just in this country, there's also unfairness. In every country where democracy is unfairness. But, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Sure. Do you have comments?
Yeah, I just wanted to actually catch Srećko's thought where he was mentioning where the nationalism from Yugoslavia came. And I completely agree. It came from greed that was wrapped up around free market economy. But the point is that it happened, yeah? In 1972, in former Yugoslavia, you had 2,200 production facilities. Today, there are less than 200, yeah? So the question is, like, going to your thought, now that you have the model of the EU as you do, and the alternatives are Russians or Chinese, what can you do in order to reinvent the model? Is it delinking that should be done internally rather than externally, rather than jumping out? And there are models in this country. There is John Lewis. There are stakeholders models around Bologna and north of Italy, which could really help reinvent locally and delink from this bad, or you want to call it, greed-driven capitalism. Yeah. So is that something that you could explore further?
Okay, so we've got two themes here. One is, hang on, where does the problem come from? Are there issues of responsibility? And then there's the issue of what kinds of new structures would be should be invoked, which could perhaps reposition responsibility. Mm. So do you have comments on that?
Sure. I'd like to answer to the second question.
Yeah.
Maybe Kostas can answer to the first because it was directly.
Yeah.
Do you want to go first?
No.
No, what I forgot to mention, you know the guy who is called Slobodan Milošević, probably, all of you.
Yeah.
You know what he was doing before he was a nationalist?
He was a banker.
in US, and then he came back. I mean, that's not a proof, of course, by itself, but anyway.
And study in America.
Excuse me?
And study in America.
Yes. And he was like a Wall Street companion, whatever. Anyway, what I wanted to say, I completely agree with you. And there are experiments like this. I think Mondragon is the best example. You know, it's a Spanish company which functions like a cooperative, a workers' cooperative, and it's the fourth in the country. I mean, when it comes to growth and to everything, you know. And there are even other examples. Of course, those are not economic examples, but Kostas knows them well. For example, Teatro Valle in Rome, which is a very good example of a theater where the theater workers, producers, directors, actors, and so on run the theater, and it's self-management as its best.
Yeah.
You know, it was supposed to be a casino, but they occupied the theater, and there are many examples in Italy. Or take, for example, the now I'm jumping, but just to show various examples, take for example the potato movement in Greece, which is actually a very good idea, not only for Greece but also for Croatia or for some other pigs, for some other countries from the periphery. And the main idea behind the potato movement is to avoid the big monopoly supermarkets and to sell the goods from village
the
to
middle, the middlemen,
people.
The middlemen,
yeah.
Come and
exactly.
buy and then sell and have huge markups.
But the whole cooperative structure in North Italy is vertically integrated fair trade in a way.
So those are the examples. But if you ask me a theoretical answer, I would answer actually give them the neoliberalism and then see what will happen.
Mm.
My thesis is if you will give real neoliberalism what they're trying to preach, but it's not neoliberalism if you ask me, it's order liberalism. Most of the biggest firms in Croatia and in other parts of Croatia of Europe would just collapse because they wouldn't have the subsidies from the government. They wouldn't have tax havens and so on. I mean, you know probably Todorić very well from Croatia. It's the case, and those people are preaching neoliberalism. So I think now I jump a step further, but I think there are good examples how the situation could be, or the suggestion by Alexis Tsipras for a debt conference. You know, when Germany was in 1953 after the Second World War, half of the debt of Germany was just erased, and why not to do the same in Greece or anywhere else? And I'm not just speaking abstractly, I finished here because it's important, because I think the audience here doesn't know about it. Another guy, it's not Milošević, it's not Tuđman, but it's Ivo Sanader. He's the ex-prime minister who, when he was the prime minister, prime minister of Croatia. He was the most European prime minister in all the Balkans and so on. And he ended up in prison and he serves now his term for 10 years or something. And they found out that he is guilty because in 95, when the war was still happening, he got the whole country indebted from an Austrian bank and got a very huge, you know, envelope with huge money and so on. And the how do you call it? Kamate.
Interest.